All right. So how many of you would consider yourselves to be sort of regular or semi-regular readers of science fiction? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you, okay, question two is, how many of you should have answered yes to question one, but you were ashamed to admit it? Okay. A few, but you're ashamed to admit it. I remember going to a talk in the Texas conference, the 1992 Texas conference on relativistic astrophysics, and they had a little session in the evening on science and religion and philosophy. And one of the speakers got up and said, well, you know, the Europeans who invented quantum mechanics all had a rigorous classical philosophical education, whereas most American scientists these days probably grew up reading science fiction. And he said it in a sort of contemptuous way, but I figured, well, why not go for it, you know? I mean, if you've grown up reading this stuff, why not try to get something out of it? My own position, as most of you know, is I'm a sort of professional scientist and a semi-professional science fiction writer. So I've published about six or seven or eight, I guess coming up on eight short stories, mostly in Analog Magazine, which is the main outlet for so-called hard science fiction that's highly science-based. But I have not yet published a novel and probably won't do that till I retire. So before I tell you about what I'm going to talk about, let me tell you what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about the physics of Star Trek. and I mean that at two different levels. First of all, I'm not going to talk a whole lot about motion picture science fiction and TV science fiction, mostly because the level at which scientific ideas are expressed in those media tends to be pretty low. So you don't find as much science in Star Trek as you do in written science fiction. And in the second respect in which I'm not going to do the physics of Star Trek is that I'm not going to go through, kind of give the traditional talk of this type where you go through a list of science fiction ideas like time travel and warp drive and ask, is it scientifically plausible or not scientifically plausible? The reason I'm not going to do that is, first of all, it's been done already by many, many people, including Mr. Krauss, and most of you have PhDs in physics, and you can figure this stuff out on your own. So you don't need me to tell you whether time travel is a plausible idea or not, and I'm no more of an expert on it than you are. Instead, what I'd like to do is come up with some thoughts based on my own experience of trying to write science fiction and trying to kind of understand the similarities or differences between science fiction and doing science. Now, I'm going to use as my comparison not just any science but theoretical physics, both because that's what I work in and because I think in some ways there's more of a similarity between science fiction and theoretical physics than between science fiction and experimental physics. Yeah, you could take that any way you like. So I first of all want to talk about the ground rules for how ideas are introduced in science fiction and in science, and talk about what I think are some interesting similarities there. Then I want to talk about the predictive power of science fiction versus science. Then I'll talk a little bit about how ideas are presented in both cases. And finally, finish up with how scientists... whether it's scientists have an advantage in writing science fiction. This talk will be the opposite of most talks in that I'm going to move from the more speculative, vague, and unbelievable to the more concrete and true, which is the opposite of the way most of our colloquia are presented. And so we'll start off with some sort of more philosophical ideas, then I'm going to move down into sort of more concrete arenas. So the basic idea, I think, in the first point of my talk is that there's something of a similarity between science fiction writing and developing ideas in theoretical physics in the sense that both of them are a form of daydreaming. I think you sit down and you have to come up with a new idea, but they're disciplined daydreaming. You're not allowed to simply speculate arbitrarily, and surprisingly, that's as true in writing science fiction as it is true in theoretical physics. So let's think a little bit about what different kinds of theoretical physics there are. Now, most of us who do physics, whether experimental or theoretical, don't sit down to think about how the process works. And in fact, if you did, I think you it would probably hold up your research, right? We don't spend our time... are you here for the Yahoo talk? It got canceled. I'm sorry. We tried to get the word out. Yeah, but it will be rescheduled in January, February, so keep an eye out for it, okay? Sorry about that. most of us don't spend our time sort of thinking about how we do physics. It's a bit like the tightrope walker. If you stop and think how you're balancing up on the tightrope, you tend to fall off. So when you're doing theoretical physics, you just do it. You don't stop and think, what is it I'm doing, or how does it work, or you know, what are the ground rules for doing it? But if you did, I think you would come up with a variety of types of theoretical physics, not all of which are the same. Starting from the more experimental, there's sort of data analysis, which of course both experimentalists and theorists do. Then you can move down a level and talk about comparison of models with data, which is a major branch of theoretical physics, but is something that but something that also experimentalists will do. Then you get to model building, where you've got a whole batch of experimental data you're trying to explain, and you're constructing a model that ties together and explains the data. And then finally, there's a kind of bottom rung of this, which I'll call the what-if brand of doing theoretical physics. This tends to be more prevalent in the more speculative areas of physics, like high-energy theory, astrophysics, cosmology. And I think it's the last of these that is closest to the process of actually doing science fiction. So, for example, what if the speed of light were constant in all frames of reference? That's an interesting idea, and it might lead you somewhere. What if the energies in black body gases were only discrete multiples of a fixed of the frequency? That's also an interesting idea. You might want to think about the implications of that. What if the universe entered a phase of exponential expansion at early times? That's something that's less familiar to most of you. That is the basis of the theory of inflation. So the idea here is you come up with a speculative idea, and you see how far you can take that idea and where it leads you. Rob?
But all three of those ideas were come up in response to an existing
law. Right, and I'm going to talk about that. I mean, that you're not allowed to just say, I mean, what if the tooth fairy brings me candy every morning? I mean, that's not science, although it works for me. But you should try it. A new idea in theoretical physics, you're not allowed, so Rob leads right into what I wanted to say. You're not allowed to simply speculate arbitrarily in theoretical physics. First of all, and this is, you know, what separates the crackpots from the tenured faculty, is it has to be consistent with known experimental results. If you start off with a theory that contradicts the experiment, you know, even as hardcore theorist as I am, it doesn't fly, okay? You're not allowed to do it. However, I would say secondarily, and this is a more controversial statement, the theoretical ideas, even the very speculative ones, at some level have to fit into the pre-existing framework of physics. We talk about scientific revolutions, quantum mechanics, and relativity. Both of those fit into the pre-existing structure that was already there. We didn't throw out notions of space and time, we modified them. We didn't throw out notions of, you know, in relativity, we didn't throw out our way of measuring distances. We didn't. You don't just start from scratch. And this again is something that separates, I think, normal theoretical physics from crackpot physics. If you get, you know, many of us receive a steady stream of very speculative papers from people in, you know, prison and various other locations, and you read those. And the problem with them is not that they're wrong. The problem is you can't even show they're wrong because they're speaking a completely different language. They're not embedded in the theoretical framework we work in. They're so far out that they have no connection to any of the rest of the physics. And so, of course, you can't show they're wrong. And then the writers get very angry and say, well, you can't prove me wrong, so I must be right. So those are kind of the restrictions on putting a new idea in physics. But I would also say that you have to go beyond what's already known. In other words, you can't just take what's already known and regurgitate it. That's also not a new idea in physics. It's not part of the rules for coming up with a new idea. So what you're really trying to do is hit the sweet spot, right, between boring and crazy, right? You want to come up with something that's new, something that's interesting, but it, you know, it moves beyond what we already know, so it's not boring, but it's not so far beyond that it's insane, right? And this is the hardest thing to learn as a physicist, especially a theoretical physicist. It's the hardest thing to teach graduate students, and in some sense, it's not clear that you can teach it. You almost learn it by osmosis or trial and error. And in fact, this was a colleague of mine, and I don't know which one it was. It was either David Schramm or Mike Turner, one of those guys, said that you can only invoke the tooth fairy once. In other words, he said you cannot just kind of multiply speculative ideas on top of each other and expect to come up with a successful theory. No one will believe you if you do that. And there's an interesting way of thinking about this. Suppose that you invented a time machine, right? And you went back in time to the 19th century. Now, if you were a normal person, you would, of course, use your knowledge of the past to become fabulously wealthy, powerful, set yourself up as the ruler of the world. But since you're a physicist, what you want to do is, of course, steal all the best ideas of the 20th century and the 21st century and publish them first and get credit for them, right? So, you know, and unfortunately, you probably can't remember a lot of that stuff. You don't have your notes with you or your computer. So you think, well, I know how the sun works, right? That's one of the things that I really understand well. I'm going to come up with, I'm going to explain to these poor benighted people of the 19th century how the sun works, because they don't know and they don't have a successful theory. So you say, well, how does the sun work? Well, it's fusion. Well, how does fusion work? Well, you have these nuclei that fuse. Well, what are nuclei? Well, they're in the center of atoms. Well, what are atoms? Well, atoms are the things that form into molecules. And the problem is, by the time you get through this speculative chain, no one would believe you, right? You've got to tell them, you know, that there's an equivalence between energy and mass, which they wouldn't believe. You have to tell them that there are these nuclei made up of protons and neutrons, which they wouldn't believe. The problem is that this whole edifice rests on a whole chain of experimental evidence that is, you can't just start from the beginning and build on it without having that experimental evidence. So in some sense, this puts a speed limit on how fast science can progress, because you cannot get too far ahead of experimental data or the existing theoretical framework. Now, we actually have an interesting counterexample nowadays, and I'm curious to see how this will turn out, right? Because at some level, string theory is moving off into this realm of adding speculation on top of speculation, and it will be interesting to see where that ends up. Now, there's a parallel here, because much of science fiction also uses the what-if model. Certainly not all of it, but much of it relies on the idea that you can make one speculative change and follow to its logical conclusion. So what if our evolution had been guided by superior beings? That gives you 2001: A Space Odyssey. What if all living things on the planet suddenly experienced increased intelligence? That leads to a famous novel called Brainwave. And it, you know, it's interesting to work out the implications of that, because all the people become super geniuses, but they now have to fight off the farm animals who have now achieved human abilities. And the pigs are the smartest, so they're the most dangerous. What if our dreams could change reality? That gives you The Lathe of Heaven. And so many of the very most powerful science fiction stories and science fiction novels are based on this what-if model. You make one speculative change and see where it leads. But on the other hand, I'm going to argue that science fiction is in its own way restricted. You're not allowed to speculate endlessly. You're not allowed to simply come up with some arbitrary idea and follow wherever it leads. In particular, the new ideas have to be plausible in science fiction. Even if they're not rigorously scientific, they have to sound like science. They have to be logical. They have to be naturalistic. And that's what distinguishes science fiction from fantasy. If I come up with an idea where there's a rare illness which is transmitted through blood and leads to photophobia, it leads to sensitivity to light, it leads to a iron deficiency, so these people have to go out and get their iron by drinking other people's blood, that's a science fiction story, right? If I say, well, there's vampires, and I provide no explanation, that's fantasy. Okay. And new ideas in the story have to be rationalized in some scientific way. You can't normally just throw in an idea without explaining how it fits into the scientific framework. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a minute, because it's actually hard to do that kind of thing without interrupting the flow of the story. On the other hand, it's also true that science fiction has a sort of corpus of accepted knowledge like science, and there are certain ideas that have become embedded in the structure, in the culture of science fiction, and you're allowed to bring those in without justification. So I can write a time travel story. The first person who wrote one, which I think was H.G. Wells, had to provide an elaborate justification for what he was doing. Everyone who came after him just could reference H.G. Wells. You just say, you know, I built my time machine, or I built my chronosphere and I went back in time. You don't have to explain it, even though it's probably the most implausible idea in science fiction. Same thing for faster than light travel. We all know you can't go faster than the speed of light. This is very inconvenient if you want a galactic empire or any kind of, space travel, galactic space travel. So you just say, well, I jumped into my hyperdrive, warp drive, wormhole, you know, jump point. And you don't explain it, you just do it. And people know that that's acceptable. And finally, I would say many of the strongest ideas, many of the strongest novels and stories in science fiction are based on this idea of just having one invocation of the tooth fairy. Now, I'm not going to talk much about fantasy, but I do want to say a little bit about it. Fantasy, even fantasy, operates under a set of constraints. It's a much looser set, but it is still there are still constraints. Now, you're allowed, again, to do all sorts of supernatural things. You're allowed to bring in all kinds of, you know, werewolves and vampires and elves and ancient kingdoms without explanation. But there are still certain rules that apply. You expect the rules of logic to apply. If one day, you know, if chapter one is about a castle with a knight, you don't expect chapter two to be about some person sitting down in a manual typewriter, and suddenly chapter three jumps to, you know, an airplane flying through space. You still have logical consistency. And in a sense, that's why fantasy is not dreamlike. There was a strain of fantasy in the 19th century, Gogol and Hoffman and a few others, which was a very dreamlike fantasy. And those stories really do make no sense. There's a famous story by Gogol about a guy who wakes up and his nose is missing. And he goes and chases, and then he sees his nose running through town. And he chases after, and then he finds it baked into a loaf of bread. I think we recognize this as the kind of thing that happens in your dreams, right? They don't make any sense, and they're incoherent, and they're illogical. That fantasy was kind of wiped out, and the person who wiped it out was actually J.R.R. Tolkien, because he pioneered what's called, somewhat contradictorily, realistic fantasy. Because his fantasy was sort of fantasy with hard edges. It was fantasy that made sense, although it was a sort of fantastic world. So the train of events in fantasy generally has to be coherent, and the characters also have to have understandable motivations. And in that sense, fantasy tends to be even more conservative than science fiction, because it's not unusual in science fiction to read stories of alien races with completely incomprehensible motivations, very strange ideas and psychologies. Fantasy, I think, because it's in some sense more liberal with its fantastic ideas, tends to be much more conservative psychologically, right? I mean, we've all read one too many stories that are basically the medieval world. Well, it's actually the 20th century translated to a medieval setting with elves and dwarves, right? This is a classic hack fantasy plot. And so in many ways, fantasy tends to be more conservative in terms of its psychological structure than science fiction does. So I would argue that just as there's a kind of concentric circles in how you introduce ideas in science, there's a similar structure in science fiction. In the center, you have mainstream fiction, where you're not allowed to introduce any fantastic elements. I mean, if you're reading a Tom Clancy novel, and halfway through, the alien invaders come in and smash the communists in Russia, that would be very disturbing. You wouldn't like that, right? And there's a kind of implied contract. When you read a novel of that kind, you know, you buy a Tom Clancy novel, you want, you know, guns and ICBMs. You don't want science fiction. Science fiction operates under a somewhat looser set of constraints, and fantasy, of course, still looser. So in some sense, these, you know, mainstream fiction is kind of like boring, and science fiction is like regular science, and fantasy is like string theory. Yeah?
Where would you stick stuff called magical realism like Gabriel Garcia Marquez on this?
Yeah, I don't like that stuff, so I probably wouldn't put it on my chart. Yeah, I'd probably put it out there with the fantasy. I'm of course oversimplifying, just like any colloquium would. Okay. Now, the essential characteristic of new ideas in physics is their predictive character. I'm not actually going to discuss this in great detail. It, you know, if you don't believe physics is predictive, then you know you should quit the game and take up something else. We can debate that after the talk. But I you know, the argument is that physics is in fact a predictive science. Is science fiction similarly predictive? Well, there are many famous cases of science fiction stories which did predict the future. One of the most famous is Jules Verne's novel in the 1860s about the first moon launch, where he predicted that it would be the Americans who launched the rocket. He predicted a three-man crew. He predicted that it would be launched from Florida following a site selection competition, which he details. And the only thing he got wrong is that he had it being launched from the west coast of Florida instead of the east coast. It's also true that if you take... He gives a budget for how much it costs, and if you take that budget and extrapolate it forward, allowing for inflation, it's within 10% of the actual cost of the moon budget. So the guy was pretty amazing. Maybe he was a time traveler. Numerous authors in the 30s and 40s predicted nuclear power. There's a very famous incident. Cleve Cartmill, who was a fairly minor writer, speaking as another minor writer, wrote a book about the atomic bomb for the ancestor of the magazine I publish in, Astounding Science Fiction. And the offices were then raided by the FBI in 1944 because they wondered if he knew you know, what was going on in the Manhattan Project. And the editor, of course, was thrilled by this and, you know, trumpeted all over the place after the war about how his offices had been raided. And, of course, Arthur C. Clarke predicted communication satellites, but he did so in a nonfiction article. It was not a science fiction article. On the other hand, I think there are many instances where science fiction missed the boat. We were promised, for example, nuclear power that would give us electricity that was too cheap to meter, and instead we got phone calls that were too cheap to meter. We were promised that everyone would be connected to a large central computer, right? This is the 1950s dream of the big giant brain in the middle of the city. Instead, what we got was everyone with a desktop supercomputer, although we're moving back toward the large central computer, if that's what you consider the World Wide Web to be. We were warned about the population bomb. We were not warned about the Social Security bomb. We were promised robots as cooks and maids. Now, how many of you would not like a robot cooking dinner tonight? Instead, we got robots making our cars. Okay, so
vacuum cleaners.
Excuse me?
Robot vacuum cleaner.
Well, and yeah. And although you can consider, I mean, it has been pointed out that an automatic dishwasher is essentially a robot, right? It is a robot that washes your dishes. You just have to get the dishes. You have to find something to load the dishes in.
But it's just a matter of time, right?
Right. Well, my children do that, so. Okay.
On a good day.
Now, we have other, you know, there's other yesterdays, tomorrows that never are. These are all the things that we were promised that never happened, right? Colonization of the solar system. We should be on, you know, Jupiter's moons by now. Contact with extraterrestrial life. The whole personal, you know, helicopter, autogyro, rocket pack, you know, we should be able to take off from our backyards with our rocket packs and fly to work and not have to worry about parking. Of course, rocket packs were invented, and they were actually used in the 60s. They consume fuel at an enormous rate, and they tend to be very unstable. If you get in the downward path, it's very bad. And, of course, death rays, which are pictured in this prescient photo of Captain Future and the Wizard of Science. In fact, this is such an interesting theme, the idea of the predictions which failed, that the Smithsonian sponsored an exhibit called Yesterday's Tomorrows. And it was a traveling exhibit. I saw it, I think, at the Museum of Science in Chicago, but it traveled around the country. And here's an example. I'm going to read these because I don't think you're going to be able to read them. Here are some of the other things that they pointed out. The upper one with the hose, it says, because everything in her home is waterproof, the housewife of 2000 can do her daily cleaning with a hose. And she's hosing down the couch, and it's going into that central drain in the middle. Bottom left, it says, housewives in 50 years may wash dirty dishes right down the drain. Cheap plastic would melt in hot water. Now, the last sentence is correct, because you can put those in a dishwasher, but of course we don't have disposable dishes. And on the right-hand side it says, already available is an electronic stove which can prepare a meal in 75 seconds. It may replace present ranges. And we all know that that was just a prediction that was kind of 90 degrees askew, because we do have microwaves and they do heat food up and it tastes like chewing gum when you're done. So it didn't quite work out. Now the other interesting thing about this is that in some sense the way in which they missed the mark is even more than that, these technological things, because when I say the word housewife, it's jarring, isn't it? Nobody uses that word anymore. And it's because science fiction has an even worse record in predicting sociological changes than it does in predicting technological changes. If you read, you know, books from the 1930s, you're much more likely to see the society of the 1930s transported to the present, and they might have gotten a few of the technical details right. They almost never get the sociological details right. So I'm going to argue that science fiction is not predictive, that the few times that it has been predictive, it just got lucky. And the reason is that it doesn't pretend to be predictive. The function of science fiction is not to predict the future. It's to provide interesting stories. And the ideas that you introduce are useful insofar as they promote these interesting stories, but they're not central to the purpose of science fiction. Science fiction is sometimes called the literature of ideas. But I think that's actually a very misleading statement, because ideas are not the center of science fiction. They're secondary to this purpose. And to illustrate this, there's a famous joke I tell my class. Well, I don't tell the class, I just mention it. You know, when I teach quantum mechanics, I mention that quantum mechanics and general relativity are, you know, incompatible, and we don't have a theory. But if you come up with one in the course of the year, let me know, and I'll write it up with you, and we'll publish under both of our names. And, you know, chuckle, chuckle, right? The story in science fiction is that somebody comes up to you and says, I had this great idea, why don't you write it up and we'll share credit for it, right? And these are exact opposite, because in science, the idea is 99% of the work, and the presentation, the actual writing up, is 1%. This is, I think, something a lot of graduate students have trouble coming to understand, because, you know, their advisor gives them this idea, then they go off and work on it for 3 months, they do all the hard work, they do the computing, they might even write the paper, and then this guy signs his name to the paper. I mean, what does he get to do that for? It's because the idea is the main thing. It's the idea that's central, and the presentation is really secondary. In science fiction writing, ideas are a dime a dozen. Now, that's not really true, and people, writers will say that, and I think they're wrong. But it is true that that the writing and the presentation is really the primary thing in science fiction, and the idea is secondary to that primary purpose. And simply coming up with a new idea does not make a science fiction story. You know, you can say, well, I have this great idea. I'll just, you know, and I'm going to write it, and that's my story. That's not an idea is not a story. You need something to keep the reader interested. You need characters, you need a plot, and you need something to keep people reading. There's a famous quote by Fred Pohl, who was a science fiction editor. He said, you don't need to predict the car, you need to predict the traffic jam. And he's saying that it's not the technology that's important, it's the change in society. I would argue that that statement isn't even correct. It's not the car that's interesting, it's not the traffic jam that is interesting, it's the guy stuck in the traffic jam who goes nuts and starts shooting his gun that's interesting, right? It's the effect that it has on people that makes it a story. And the previous two things are not central to that. There's another limit, you know, coming back to this idea of predictive power, there's another limit, I think, that affects the predictive power of science fiction written by scientists. I call this, I just made up this term, the NSF effect. That's Mike Turner, who was formerly at the NSF. And this is an argument as to why it's difficult for scientists to make predictions when they're writing science fiction. And let me give you an example from writing a grant. Let's say you're writing a grant proposal and you're an experimentalist. Let's say that you're Charlie. And you're writing your proposal, and you've got an experiment, you kind of, you know what you want to measure, you've got a technique for measuring it, you know why it's an interesting problem, you write it up. Okay, that's reasonable. But now suppose you're a theorist writing a proposal, and you have some idea, for example, to explain dark energy. Well, that's too vague, so you need to put in more detail. Well, you've got a new scalar field you want to put in, and that's too vague, so you then say, well, you know, it'll have this kind of potential. And actually, you can do a few computer simulations and show what it might produce. Well, by the time you finish up, you've actually done the project, right? So, you know, how do theorists write proposals? Well, it's sort of a third stuff they've already done, a third they're never going to do, and a third they're working on now. That's not quite true, but close enough. The same thing is true if you're writing science fiction. If I sit down to write a science fiction story, and it's in my own field of research, and I come up with a really cool idea in cosmology, and I start writing it, well, if it's really an accurate description, why am I writing a science fiction story? I get more, you know, yum-yums from the department, from the chairman, if I write it up as a journal article. So I think that inherently limits the ability to make predictive power in science fiction. Once you're really predicting things accurately, it's not science fiction anymore. Now let me move on to the third topic, which is how are ideas presented in science fiction? So here we're going to get a little more concrete. In science, it's very straightforward. You're writing your paper. You discuss the background of the subject. You discuss why you're interested in it. You discuss the previous work. You cite all previous work that you ever did, and a little bit that other people have done, okay? You present your results, you summarize your conclusions, and then, oddly enough, you give away the punchline by putting your abstract at the beginning and telling people what you're going to tell them. So you have a little summary and say, this is really interesting, you should read the paper, here's what I've discovered, okay? Very straightforward. In science fiction, it's not so simple. Okay? It is actually much more difficult to introduce ideas. Now, I'm going to read this out loud, so bear with me. But let's suppose that you wanted to write a science fiction story, and in the middle of it, you have to introduce an idea. Let's suppose, this is something I just wrote up for this talk. Joe Waltham burst into the ship's control room. Klaxons wailed and the neutrino gauges flickered wildly. Billy shouted, the solar neutrino detectors have gone crazy. The sun produces neutrinos in the course of its fusion reactions. Two protons bind to form deuterium, producing a positron and an electron neutrino. The electron neutrino can escape from the sun's core. Bill rushed over to check the detector feeds. I don't see anything wrong at this end. Now, what is wrong with that? That is a good story. It's exciting. The problem is you have this big lump in the middle of it, an indigestible lump. And science fiction actually has its own jargon, just like science does. Everyone, every field has its own jargon. This is known in the trade as an info dump, because you need to explain something, so you just stop the story and say, oh, and by the way, let me tell you something, and then you get back to the story. The problem, of course, is that it slows down the story and is likely to lose the reader's interest. So let's rewrite this and try to fix it, okay? Bill rushed over to check the detector feeds. I don't see anything wrong at this end. He turned to Joe. As you know, Joe, the sun produces neutrinos in the course of its fusion reactions. Yes, said Joe, I know that. And you also know that two protons bind to form deuterium, producing a positron and an electron neutrino. Joe nodded. Yes, I know that too, but why are you telling me all these things that I already know? Okay. This is another kind of beginner's mistake, and it has a name too, which surprisingly is called As You Know, Bob, right? Because, I'm not kidding, I don't know how I got involved in this, but that's the technical term for it. It's when there's nothing wrong with having information introduced in dialogue, and it can be done very effectively. But the first mistake is to have one character explain to the other something they already know, and it doesn't make any sense. Why would you spend all this time explaining, something they already know? So these are not good ways to introduce ideas. So exposition is very tricky, because you want to introduce the new information, but you don't want to interrupt the flow of the story. So the way that it's normally done, it's like sneaking it in. It's much more difficult than a science paper. You have to kind of do it in little bits and pieces, and you're allowed to have a little exposition if it's, deep in the buried in the story, and it's done in a sort of smooth way, and it's hard to know when that works and when it doesn't work. So I'll give you an example from one of my stories, not because I think they're better than anybody else's stories, because I had them on my computer. Okay. So this is from a story, November 2004. Jimmy Dyson pushed his bicycle through the sun-baked field behind Benny Krause's house, spraying clouds of dandelion seeds into the air and jostling the cargo in his basket mounted on the handlebars. Withered thistles caught on the scratchy wool socks his mom always made him wear, even in the St. Louis summer. "Benny, it came yesterday," Jimmy shouted, lifting a red brick-red box from the basket and waving it in the air. It has Bob Gibson on the cover. Okay, so this is a sort of random narration, just a little story going along, but it actually provides a lot of information. How old are these? How old are these people? Any guesses?
10.
They're actually a little older. They're 12, 13, something like that. How do you know that? Well, the guy's riding a bicycle. His mom tells him what kind of socks to wear, so that's pretty clearly, I won't make any comments on that, but, and where does the story take place? It takes place in St. Louis. That name is not an accident. Actually, Dyson and Krause I put in on purpose, but there are only a few 20 or 30 people in the world that will get the joke. And now you've heard it. Where does it take place? In St. Louis. And yet, I didn't have to tell everybody it took place in St. Louis. It just got mentioned. And what's it about? Generally, it's going to be about something. Baseball. Because the title of the story is Extra Innings, and we have Bob Gibson. And for those of you who don't know who Bob Gibson was, he played baseball in St. Louis in the 1960s. And later on, we learn that, in fact, the story takes place in 1969. Okay. Now, let's jump ahead a little bit. Well, no, let's not jump ahead. Let me mention something else. You're actually operating under two sets of constraints, because on the one hand, you don't want to dump in information too fast. But on the other hand, it's especially important in science fiction stories to establish the parameters of the story, because there is so much freedom. Right? If I'm writing a story about the Russian Empire, or about, the U.S. at the turn of the century, you kind of get a sense of what it is about, right? But science fiction stories can take place on the Earth, or they could be on another planet. The hero can be a human being or an octopus. And so it's very important at the beginning of the story to establish exactly when the story is taking place, where it's taking place, and who's the protagonist. And so you're kind of operating under these twin constraints. You can't say too much too fast, but on the other hand, you better pin the story down, or the characters, you're going to kind of read through it. I read one story. I used to belong to a writer's workshop in Columbus, and you didn't find out if the protagonist was male or female until like page 3. And it was very disturbing, because most people came in thinking it was male, and then you discover it's female. That's an interesting literary trick, but probably not something you want to do in a slam-bang adventure story, right? Pin that down. And all this has to be done without interrupting the flow of the story. So we go to the next. There's a break in the story. He goes on to the next section. So, Ben, what have you been up to? Asked Jim, bouncing 3-year-old Evan on his knee while Laura cleared the dishes from the dinner table. We haven't seen you in how long? 2 years. Been pretty busy at work, said Ben. It took a lot settling into a frayed armchair. It took a long time to set up the Neuro AI Institute, and I've got to write grant proposals every year just to keep it going. MIT loves us, but they don't give us much money. So what has happened here? Well, clearly this is in the far, much later in time, because one of them has a child, a three-year-old. One of them has a, you know, works at MIT and is doing research on neuro AI, whatever that is. Then there's another break. This is a kind of an unusual story because it progresses chronologically very fast. There's another break in the story, and we get to this. Jim Dyson dragged himself up the hospital steps, wheezing and stopping every three steps to catch his breath. Each time he put weight on his left leg, his knee burned like someone had driven a hot knife under the kneecap. At least the knee pain took his mind off his constant backache. What was the point of living in 94 if he felt like death warmed over? But damned if he was going to discarnate until Laura did. Now, again, you can see, you know, he's much older now. He may be near death. But the interesting thing about this section of the story is that I throw in a word that doesn't exist. Discarnate. Okay, it's not, you won't find that anywhere. And that's another way of introducing information in the sense that there's an implied contract in science fiction. You can throw in nonsense terms or strange ideas, and the implied contract is eventually you'll find out what they mean. Yeah.
If you can incarnate, why can you not discarnate?
Well, I think you can. Okay. But it's not in the dictionary. Let's put it that way. And it doesn't mean in this story to die. It means something else. So the idea there is that you're allowed to bring in weird ideas, and that can actually be a way of getting the reader hooked on the story. Okay, you don't have to explain everything right away. You could throw in a weird idea to get the reader hooked, and then explain it five pages later, having kept the reader's attention for at least another five pages. Here's another example. This is the beginning of another story I wrote. My death day is July 18th. I spent it this year, as I have every year for the past 10, at home in bed with my wife nearby. I can't afford a private doctor, and I've heard too many iatrogenic horror stories to check into the hospital for the day. So I lay quietly, imagining all the different ways it could happen. A sudden squeezing pain in my chest, or maybe a jackhammer headache, announcing a burst blood vessel. Now the question here is, what the heck's going on, right? So I introduced this idea of death day. His death day is July 18th, but obviously it doesn't mean he died on July 18th because he's still alive. So what the heck is going on, right? The idea is to confuse but sort of entice at the same time. You keep the reader off balance, but try to get them to read the story by making enough weird, enough interesting, unusual ideas to keep them, to kind of suck them in. Later on, what you discover in the story, and again, it's part of the implied contract, you have to eventually explain what's going on, what you discover is that, for reasons that you have to read the story to find out, everyone discovers the day on which they're going to die, the day of the year, but not the actual year. So they're extra careful that day when it rolls around every year. Okay. Now, in science fiction, you have to strike this balance between giving too much information up front, which is boring, and too little, which is incomprehensible. In science, it's the other way around. You want all the information up front. Okay? You put everything in the abstract. And you are not allowed to introduce new terms and then five pages later explain what you meant. I mean, not on purpose, anyway. I mean, we've all done that by accident. But good practice for learning how to write a science paper is if there's a new symbol in the equation, you explain right underneath the equation what it means, right? And not say, oh, I forgot to tell you, by the way, phi was really not an angle this time around. It's really a chemical potential. That's okay. You would never give an abstract in a science fiction story. You would never put a summary at the front saying, here's what the story is about. And that's another common mistake people make when they send a story to an editor. In the cover letter, they give a summary of the story. Okay, that works fine in a physics paper, but it doesn't work fine in fiction because you've ruined the story and the editor probably won't even read it. The odd thing, though, is I think both types of writing have the same goal, just coming at it from different directions. You're trying to get someone to read what you've written. And in science fiction, you do that by presenting interesting situations up front without fully explaining what's going on because that makes the person want to read. In a physics paper, you put the abstract up front, and you put all your most exciting results in the abstract and hope that will convince the person to read the paper, or at least cite it if they don't read it. Okay. What about writing styles? Well, here you couldn't see a bigger difference. Okay, in science writing, we learn to write in the passive voice. We never do anything. It always gets done. In fact, I refereed a paper recently which was so passive that at one point I couldn't tell whether they were claiming a result was being done by them or had already been done. And I in my referee report, I said, what's the deal here? And they rewrote it, and it turns out they had done it. But it was written in such a way that you couldn't tell. You qualify everything. OK, Okay, and that's essential, I think, just from the business of doing science, because we rarely are able to make blanket statements, so things are somewhat true or often true or there's interesting trends. We don't ever make, I've discovered this, it's true, sort of thing. Numerous parenthetical clauses, many compound nouns. So I blame Tobias for this. I think this is a relic of German, right? I mean, there's the famous Tom Wolfe story about how all airplane pilots started talking like Chuck Yeager. At some time in the 1930s, I think all scientists started writing like Germans because they were doing all the science. And so I think there's this relic of German grammar in our science writing, which is you're allowed to string together an arbitrary number of nouns. Now, you don't make it into a single word, but it's okay. In science fiction, very different. You avoid passive constructions. That's like poison. Okay? You emphasize vivid language, verbs, and adjectives. Avoid adverbs because that's considered sort of weak writing. Let me give you an example. Here's the same story I wrote, I mentioned earlier, the Jimmy Dyson story. Now, what I'm going to do is show you how you would take this story and you would write it as a physics article. Okay? It would look like this. A bicycle was pushed by Jimmy Dyson through the sun-baked Benny Krause house field. Thus, dandelion seeds were dispersed into the air and the cargo in the handlebar mounted basket was somewhat jostled. Thistles, fairly withered, see discussion in part two below, were caught on Dyson socks. The story takes place in St. Louis in the summer. So, that would be a perfectly respectable physics article, and you can see that the writings, and you recognize your own writing style there. I mean, who has not written a paper like that? And it's just that, it's a different style for a different need, okay? And preferred writing styles can change. Here's an example, which, again, goes by this jargon term of Tom Swifty. So here's Tom Swift and his giant robot. It's actually not clear that this was ever used in the Tom Swift books, but somehow it got named Tom Swifties. And this was very common at the turn of the the 20th century, and now has fallen out of disfavor. This is a section from one of the Wizard of Oz books from 1907. And you can see that in this story, no one ever just says anything. Grumbled the king, said Dorothy earnestly, said Evering with much dignity, cried Bellina with a cluck that was meant for a laugh. Oh, and then finally Dorothy just says something. Said Dorothy. Answered Bellina, thoughtfully. So you see, no one has ever actually just... You have to qualify every said tag there. Modern style has evolved to where this is very much out of favor. That you just, you just say, he said this, he said that. Occasionally they can, whisper or snap or something like that. But if you use too many of those, it sounds weird. So most of the time you just say, he said or she said. And very often you leave off the tag entirely. You just have lines of dialogue separated by paragraphs going from one character to another. Yeah, so it's different. Yeah, exactly. Finally, do scientists have an advantage in writing science fiction or not? I mean, this is an interesting topic of discussion because if you go on some of the science fiction magazine discussion boards, they'll say, well, it's not fair because these scientists can just plunk down science fiction very easily, and they're publishing all the stories. There are certainly science fiction writers with a science background, and many of the most famous writers from earlier in the last 100 years had a science background. Isaac Asimov had a PhD in chemistry and taught at Boston University for many years. Robert Heinlein did graduate work in physics. Arthur C. Clarke had a bachelor's degree in physics, and Larry Niven had a bachelor's degree in math. The one name that often is not mentioned is Michael Crichton, who's actually Dr. Michael Crichton. He probably actually has the best claim to being a scientist writing science fiction because he actually did postdoctoral biomedical research. I think the reason he doesn't often come to mind is first of all, science fiction aficionados don't consider him a real science fiction writer, and probably physicists don't consider a medical doctor to be a real scientist. So it's, yeah, okay. So that's why he doesn't often end up on these lists. There also are many scientists, some of whom are known to people in this room, who've dabbled in science fiction, and I would put myself in that list. John Kramer, who is a RIC physicist at University of Washington, has written a science fiction novel. Don Clayton does nuclear astrophysics at Clemson. He's written a novel in which he wrote John Bacall as a character into the novel. Craig Wheeler at Texas has written a novel. And there are quite a few kind of scientists who've dabbled in science fiction. But I would say there are very few research scientists who've actually contributed significantly to science fiction. The two who come to mind are, first of all, Fred Hoyle. And he's, I would say, the only Nobel Prize class physicist to actually write a significant body of science fiction. And when I say Nobel Prize class, it's well known that he barely missed out on the Nobel Prize when it was given to Fowler and Chandrasekhar in the 1980s. I mean, he would have had a good claim to get it. He also passes the Encyclopedia Britannica test. He's listed in the Encyclopedia Index as a physicist. So, you know, he's as a famous scientist or a great scientist, he also wrote 10 very influential science fiction novels. So when he died, his obituary appeared on, you know, in the science magazines. It also appeared on the science fiction websites. Another person who falls into this category most likely is Greg Benford at UC Irvine, who is actually, I think, a better writer than Fred Hoyle, but not as good of a scientist. But he's maintained an active research program in plasma physics while at the same time writing quite a few science fiction novels. Wait, I don't want to actually go backwards. But in fact, the reason this list is so sparse, I think, is just a normal human reason, and that is you might also ask, why aren't there more people who play professional baseball and then do neurosurgery in the off-season, right? There's not very many, right? There aren't even very many people who play baseball in the summer and football in the winter. It's just a question of time. You either, you know, you can devote yourself full bore to being a scientist or full bore to being a science fiction writer. It's almost impossible to do both. And so most people naturally gravitate to whichever one they find themselves better at. There are a lot of scientists who basically get into science fiction, discover they're good at it, they like it, and it brings in a lot of money for them, and that's a rare number. There are also scientists who, you know, dabble in science fiction but realize that ultimately their talents lie elsewhere. So it's not that it's not common to have scientists writing science fiction, to have scientists writing science fiction as a major factor in their lives. And finally, do scientists have an advantage in writing science fiction? I think they do, but I also think it's not the advantage everyone assumes, right? The assumption that a lot of non-scientists make is, well, you could just throw down your research on a page and write a story about it. And I found that it's actually harder to write about your own research area. The first 5 stories I wrote had nothing to do with my own research area in cosmology and actually very little to do with physics. And the reason is that when you sit down to write a story and it's in your own research area, you have a much stronger filter as to what you consider plausible. So you start to write a story about your own research area and you say, well, you know, that's not quite true. You know, the melting point of gallium is not 93, it's 87, you know. Or, you know, and that's not how Rick operates, right? I mean, we have people there. You know, sometimes in a story you have to distort science to make the plot work, right? So, you know, I'm writing a story now where I've got people, you know, sneaking into a hospital room. The hospital would never let them in. They've got security, right? It's very hard to write science fiction about your own research area because you do apply a very tight filter. And the other difficulty is that the writing styles are so diametrically opposed. That's true even if you want to write a popular article. I mean, I think probably some of you have tried to write or have written popular science articles. You sit down and you start to write, and all the bad habits of writing science journal articles come out, right? The very passive style, the very turgid, you know, one fact after another writing style. You really have to break yourself of that habit. You have to kind of slap yourself in the face and say, no, don't do that. So it's a really very different writing process. And I think also the way that I've talked about how you introduce ideas, it's a very different way of expressing ideas. I think there are some advantages to being a scientist of getting into science fiction that I found personally. One mundane advantage is that you've mastered basic writing, okay? You know how to put sentences together that have verbs in them, right? And although you may laugh at this, I've been told by the science fiction editors at the magazines that 90% of what they get is actually not, you know, not grammatical. I mean, you know, sometimes they get stories written in crayon, although that's not that common. But just being able to string sentences together, I mean, I think probably our schools are not doing as good a job of writing as they did 50 years ago, and just being able to write is a significant skill. I also think that scientists have mastered the art of extrapolating new ideas from known facts. That was the topic of the first part of the talk, although it's a very different process. And it's a much, you know, it's a much more free-form process in science fiction. I think it is true that we've mastered the idea of, you know, here's a set of facts. How do I extrapolate beyond that without going out into la-la land? How do I get into the next step out and write something which is interesting without being crazy? And a very minor advantage is that many, but certainly not all, science fiction stories involve scientists. Maybe, you know, 20 or 30% of them, and we know kind of the nature of science, how it works. It's like a former policeman writing crime novels. If you're a scientist, you don't get things wrong. Now, an example of that is I was reading a story in a collection of the year's best science fiction And it was about a guy who had committed murder at a particle accelerator. So I won't give you the details because I don't want you to get any ideas. But the guy who was murdered was this very arrogant, egocentric jerk who was the director of the project. And they talk about how he had made this discovery, and then he went around at conferences giving speeches. Okay. Well, we know that scientists don't give speeches. They give talks. And as I was reading it, I was kind of jarred by that and said, what is this person talking about? And then I realized that they thought that's what you would call a scientific talk. It's a speech. And you would know, as a scientist, what the right thing to call it. So that's in some ways a very minor advantage, but I think it is something of an advantage if you're trying to write. So should you try it? Well, if you're working in our department, don't, because you need to spend all your time doing physics research and teaching and service activities. But and we know from our audit that you have no personal time. It is actually kind of, it is interesting. I mean, the nice thing about the science fiction short story market, it is one of the few remaining fiction markets that will accept and publish unsolicited manuscripts. If you send your short story into the Atlantic, it would go straight into the circular file. You know, I'm not sure they'd open the, you know, they would look at what it was and then pitch it. You need an agent to write novels. You need an agent to write short fiction at most, you know, the big name fiction outlets now. But you can actually send a story into a science fiction magazine and you'll get an answer back. Now, the answer is most likely to be no, but they do actually, you know, I know that they read unsolicited manuscripts because they read mine and they published it. So it does happen. And one last big difference between writing science and writing science fiction, which is frustrating if you're trying to write fiction, is that as in professional sports, you're only as good as your most recent performance in science fiction. In fact, you're only as good as your current performance. We know that I shouldn't say this, but if you get a paper to referee and it's by an author you know, and it's a subject you know, when you start to read it, you're going to pay a little more close attention to it than if you get a paper from some private street address in South America that is written in crayon, right? So credentials do make a difference in getting papers published, even though we would claim that they don't. I think they certainly do. They make much less of a difference in getting science fiction published. And again, I've talked to editors who say, so-and-so, this famous science fiction writer, sent me a story last week, but I had to reject it because, it wasn't what I needed that week, or I just published a story just like it, or it wasn't a very good story. So unfortunately, you have to kind of start from scratch every time. Now, I think you do get the editor to read your stuff more carefully when you've published several stories, but they do actually reject stories that that just don't meet their needs. And whereas in physics, I think we all have an expectation that we've done the research, we've written it up, it darn well better get published, right? So that's again a big difference. So to summarize, to go over the main points that are a little bit disjointed here, I would say that both theoretical physics and science fiction do involve the development of new ideas, but within well-established constraints. I argue that science fiction is not predictive, that ideas are in fact only secondary to science fiction, even though they're primary in theoretical physics, and the way that ideas are introduced are very, very, very different in the two fields. And finally, I do believe scientists have an advantage in writing science fiction, but it's not the one that everybody assumes. Okay, thank you. I'll go ahead and stop here and we'll take questions.